equally interested audience. Ms. Dickinson-Davidson, are you ready to proceed?
Chief Judge Rader, and may it please the Court. The Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation is a non-appropriated fund instrumentality under the Supreme Court's test in Hopkins and under this Court's current test, which was articulated most recently in the Ains decision.
But are you relying on Hopkins, which didn't really turn on that question?
In Hopkins, the Supreme...
They discussed it, I agree, but as a matter of...
In Hopkins, the Court discussed it, and in particular discussed the 1970 amendments to the Tucker Act, in which Congress recognized the NAFI doctrine and also considered whether to waive sovereign immunity so that all NAFIs could be subject to suit in the Court of Federal Claims. And as the Supreme Court recognized, Congress decided to waive sovereign immunity only for five specified NAFIs and not for, in that case, the Army and Air Force exchanges. But then the Supreme Court also recognized in Hopkins, quoting this Court's predecessor, that Congress's decision could lead to harsh consequences in some cases, but that that was a decision for Congress, not the courts, to make. It's interesting to look at that legislation because Congress considered whether to enact a much broader waiver than only for the five enumerated NAFIs. But even when Congress was considering the very broad waiver, which it ultimately rejected, it did not include NAFIs for which Congress had provided sue and be sued authority. So even when Congress was considering the very broad waiver for NAFIs, which it ultimately rejected, the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation, which can sue and be sued in its own name in district courts, would not have been included. And Congress explained why it wasn't even proposing that or considering that. It was because it had already provided a forum in which those NAFIs could be sued. And that's exactly the case here. And that's why there aren't harsh consequences here. The FDIC can and could be sued in the district court. But Congress has not provided a waiver in the Court of Federal Claims for suits against the FDIC.
Are you suggesting that in any situation in which the agency has the right to sue or be sued in its own name, the United States is not independently subject to suit in the Court of Federal Claims?
If the agency is a NAFI, doesn't receive appropriated funds, and it has a sue and be sued clause, then it can't be sued in the Court of Federal Claims.
So the government's position is that these entities can be sued for damages for breach of contract in courts outside of the Tucker Act.
The FDIC and any other entity which has a sue and be sued clause, and that's consistent with this Court's decision in Far West.
And the consequences of that, therefore the difference, though, is the pot of money which is accessible for damages.
Well, there's two differences. One is, of course, sovereign immunity, that Congress has only waived sovereign immunity in the Court of Federal Claims for certain activities involving the government, and particularly, except for the five exceptions, for appropriated activities. And that allows Congress to monitor and manage the extent to which the Treasury is exposed to claims, because only if Congress has appropriated funds to an activity and said, we want you to do this with the taxpayer dollars, that exposes the government, the Treasury, to claims later on based upon those activities.
I thought you just told me that the government's position now is that suits for a breach of contract and damages for breach can be awarded outside of the Tucker Act by the regional circuits.
If an agency has a sue and be sued clause, then under this Court's decision in Far West, if it's an appropriated activity...
No, I'm asking what the government's position is, because as you know, and as was cited, there are a number of cases which have held that the regional circuits cannot award damages for breach of contract. So I'm trying to understand if the government's has changed its position those cases.
No. In some of those cases, the FDIC was sued, as in Far West, the FDIC was sued in its capacity as manager of the Physic Resolution Fund. That is an appropriated activity, and for that reason, the United States never objected to the jurisdiction or moved to dismiss or claimed that the Physic Resolution Fund was enacted in any of the Windstar cases. This is not a Windstar case. It is a bank insurance case. That fund, which is the main fund operated by the FDIC, only received appropriated funds once 70 years ago when Congress by statute required the FDIC to repay those funds with interest. So for 70 years, it hasn't received a dime of appropriated funds. It also, in 1991, Congress actually overruled the Office of Legal Counsel, which issued an opinion saying that although the FDIC was a NAFI, it still had to apportion its funds to make sure that it would manage its budget on an annual basis and not run out of money by the end of the year. And in 1991, Congress reversed the Office of Legal Counsel and said, no, the FDIC doesn't have to apportion its funds. It's completely independent of the federal budgeting process.
What happens when there's extra money from the FDIC till the end of the year? Does Congress take it?
No. No,
they leave it there. It doesn't get sort of sucked into the general
fund. No, not at all. In fact, the FDIC doesn't even keep its funds in the Treasury in a separate account, which some non-appropriated fund activities, for example, the Mint keeps its money in the Treasury in a separate account. The FDIC actually keeps its money in banks. It doesn't even put its money into the Treasury.
What would be the consequence if there were a district court judgment under the Sue and Be Sued clause for exactly this kind of breach of contract claim, and the judgment came to $300 million. Would the FDIC be good for that, either out of their funds on hand or by either borrowing or assessing banks? Would it have an obligation to come up with the money by one of its various means available to it?
If it had a judgment against it, it would have an obligation to pay the judgment. If it didn't have the funds on hand, it could borrow commercially.
Right, but it would have an obligation to obtain the funds, correct?
Well, like any corporation, it would have an obligation to pay the judgment. The judgment would not be paid out of the judgment fund. It would be paid out of the deposit insurance fund, which is the fund at issue here, which is one of the ironies of this case if the court were to conclude that this is a case within the jurisdiction of the Court of Federal Claims. Ultimately, the judgment would be paid by the deposit insurance fund, not by the judgment fund.
How would that happen? If in fact the judgment would be issued by the Court of Claims, wouldn't the judgment then be payable from the judgment fund?
No, the judgment fund is a default. If Congress has specified a particular fund for the payment of judgments, the judgments are paid out of that fund and not the judgments fund. So, for example, in the Winstar cases, the judgments were paid out of the FISLIC resolution fund.
That was a special fund that was set up by Congress to pay for the FISLIC and the Winstar case.
Exactly. And that is the fund that the plaintiffs cite when they say that the FDIC has received all this appropriated money. Actually, that was money put into a special agency that Congress created.
I'm not entirely clear. If there's a judgment for $500 billion and it comes in the district court and the FDIC does not have that money, at least on hand, in the absence of borrowing it or giving new assessments, is then the general fund the fallback for the remainder?
No, it's not available in that situation. The judgment
fund
is not.
But in the Court of Claims, if there was a judgment in this case, if we decided there was jurisdiction here and the court and there was an award of $500 billion, first you go to the FDIC funds, but assuming that there are no funds, not sufficient funds, then the fallback would be the general treasury.
Right? I don't think so, because the judgment fund is only available where there has been a general appropriation, and there has been no, under 2517, 28 U.S.C. section 2517, judgments can only be paid when there has been a general appropriation. But even if that were true, you'd have the anomaly that an entity that Congress has clearly instructed not to receive appropriated funds and hasn't received appropriated funds for 70 years suddenly would have the taxpayers paying its judgments, even though the taxpayers don't pay for all of its activities.
But the FDIC hasn't been insolvent until this year. So you're saying just as when the FSLIC became insolvent, a new system was established through the resolution fund and then turning it over to the FDIC for the thrifts as well as the savings banks. But the FDIC hasn't been insolvent, so there's been no need for an appropriation. And I'm trying to understand this distinction that you're drawing when there was this difference in the call upon the resources of the for the thrift institutions. And now, although the origins in this case for the Meritor's predecessor was a thrift institution, but that distinction is no longer being drawn because everything's under the FDIC. And I thought I heard you, in response to Judge Prost, say that nevertheless, the full faith and credit of the United States no longer applies if the FDIC doesn't have the resources to pay its judgments.
No, I said the judgment fund would not apply. The full faith and credit
The judgment fund was established in order to pay judgments of the Court of Federal Claims.
That's correct, but you don't work backwards to say because there is a statute that would provide a source of payment for cases that are within the court's jurisdiction. Therefore, every case is within the court's general jurisdiction because there is a source of funds to pay judgments for cases that are within the court's jurisdiction.
Isn't that what you're saying?
It's very instructive. Isn't
that what you're saying with the NAFI statute? That if there's not a specific appropriation, it's not within the court's jurisdiction. If it's not within the court's jurisdiction, it can't pay its judgments with appropriated funds.
Right, but I'm looking at the front end.
The United States is not liable.
I'm looking at the activity, not just the end where there's a judgment, but the activity itself. Is this an activity that Congress has intended to fund? Here, there's no authorization for appropriations to the extent that Congress has even authorized borrowing power.
That's right, $50 billion.
But the action here is against the United States, not against the FDIC and the Court of Claims.
But
so if it's pursued against the United States, wouldn't the judgment fund be subject to the judgment instead of the FDIC? Would the U.S. then sue the FDIC for the balance out of the judgment fund?
Well, I think the plaintiffs might have to go to Congress in that case, but the FDIC so far has always paid its judgments. And no one has suggested in this case that it would not pay its judgment.
But not its suit. But not its suit in the Court of Claims.
One of two things would happen if this case went back to the Court of Federal Claims. One of two things would happen: either the court would be entertaining an action that involves a non-appropriated fund activity, and the judgment would be paid out of non-appropriated funds. So why is the Court of Federal Claims involved when Congress has said people should go to a district court? Or alternatively, what would happen is the taxpayers would pay a judgment for an activity that Congress clearly intended not to have appropriated funds used for at all. So both results are not appropriate. I would like to talk about the full faith and credit clause because I think it's very important.
Can I just ask you just to step back for a moment so that we can understand the implications of this case? How many federal agencies have the authority to sue and be sued, and how many of those, in your view, fall into the NAFI category? What are the consequences of what's before us?
I really don't know the answer to that, and I did try to find out in preparation for this argument. There are quite a few agencies that have sue and be sued clauses. The Bureau of Customs and Border Patrol is one of them. I do know that there are countless NAFIs. Everyone who has looked at the question and tried to count NAFIs.
When Congress is deciding whether to allow an agency to sue or be sued, what are the criteria for determining whether an agency should sue or be sued independently, separately?
Generally, but not exclusively, but generally agencies with sue and be sued clauses, like the FDIC, are commercially oriented. And the FDIC is an insurance company. It assesses premiums on its members, and it uses those premiums to pay damages for members who have problems. It is instructive on the FISLIC that FISLIC also had a full faith and credit backup in a 1982 resolution by Congress. But what Congress did, and this is very important, I think, that when there was a problem, Congress did step up to the plate, but it didn't give any appropriated funds to FISLIC. So the assumption that because there's a full faith and credit clause backing deposits, not the FDIC as an institution, but just the depositors' deposits in banks, that if Congress fulfills its pledge, that what that will mean is appropriating funds to the FDIC is belied by history. What Congress did in the FISLIC instance was abolish the agency, create a new agency, and give that agency enough funds to pay the depositors. But the full faith and credit clause is only a protection to the deposits of the depositors, not to the insured banks, and definitely not to the FDIC.
we referred to the borrowing a few times. The provision, the one I identified in the statute, 1824A, is that the borrowing authority? And if so, is that the only provision dealing with borrowing authority? And if so, is this broadly applicable to all of the functions of the FDIC, or is this narrowly applicable to just the deposit funds or some other
category? This is just to the, I mean, there is a separate statutory bank backup for the FIRF, which is a separate fund that the FDIC inherited 20 years ago and is going away very soon.
Well, with respect let me ask the question the other way. With respect to the BIF, is there the ability for the is there statutory borrowing authority by the FDIC? And what provision of the statute is that? Is that the 1824A?
I believe it's 1824A.
And that applies to the BIF as well as to the deposit insurance company, the insurance deposits.
It is authority for the BIF to borrow from the Treasury, which it has never done, and if it does, it requires approval by the Secretary of Treasury and repayment at market
interest rates. But is 1824A limited to BIF, or is it applicable to other aspects?
No, it's limited to the bank insurance funds. There is a separate backup for the FISA resolution fund.
If there was no sue and be sued clause, would you then agree that jurisdiction would lie in the Court of Federal Claims?
No, then this case would be like Ames or Farash. It would be a NAFI. It would involve a NAFI for which there has been no waiver of sovereign immunity anywhere. But this is not that harsh case. And in Ames, this court said, well, the obligations of the Mint are not subject to judicial review because Congress has not provided for it.
So in your view, the sewer be sued clause is irrelevant to the statutory interpretation of 1491. You're just using that as a basis to make us feel better because then there isn't, in fact, no place that suit can be brought, right? That's you're divorcing from statutory interpretation.
I always want you to feel better, but I am using it to illustrate that there are no harsh consequences in this case, but it's also relevant to the 1970 amendments because Congress expressly considered the situation of non-appropriated fund activities with sue and be sued clause, and that's exactly this agency.
But the agency could have been sued in district court by Slattery.
Yes, absolutely.
On that basis,
absolutely.
In federal district court,
and
the waiver of sovereign immunity under the sue and be sued provision is there, and then any judgment which they would have obtained, if any, would have been gone against the FDIC's funds.
That's correct.
And not the judgment funds of the U.S. government.
That's correct. And if it also makes you feel better, the United States is on record, and I will repeat it now, that we would not oppose a transfer of this case to the district court as long as the plaintiffs recaptioned the case to be against the FDIC, which is the case they should have brought.
What about the fact that the statute provides not only a sue or be sued clause, but also allows the FDIC to enter into contracts? Is your argument that the contract here is not with the United States, but with the FDIC?
That's correct, because it's a non-appropriated fund activity.
Well, I guess what I'm asking is somewhat similar to what Judge Moore was asking, and that is, what consequences should we draw from the fact that the FDIC has an independent contracting authority in the statute? Does that mean that the contracts it executes are contracts with the FDIC rather than contracts with the United States?
Yes, because the FDIC is not supported with appropriated funds and is not authorized to bind the United States in contract. It is only authorized to bind itself in contract.
But in the Windstar, and in all of the cases that reach us, whether they come directly from the Boards of Contract Appeals or the Court of Federal Claims, the contract is with the agency. Are you, in answer to Judge Dyke's question, saying that those cases are not under the Tucker Act because they're not with the United States?
No. If they are contracts made with funds that Congress has appropriated, then of course they are within the jurisdiction of the Court of Federal Claims. But the Supreme Court recognized in Hopkins and Congress recognized in the 1970 amendments, and it's consistent with the history of the court, that the court was created to divert the mountains of requests to Congress for private bills to come out of the Treasury by U.S. citizens. Congress was drowning in these requests for appropriated funds from individual citizens and said, let's create a forum that can consider these requests and hear from the other side. The government will have a solicitor who will come in, and so the decision maker can hear from both sides. But those were all claims for appropriated funds, because that's all Congress had.
Well, that was in the 1800s with the Court of Claims.
That's correct.
It was formed for congressional referrals.
But nothing has changed since then. In standard
but the judgment
oil.
Fund has changed.
Excuse me?
But the judgment fund has changed. With the inception of the judgment fund, it's very clear in the legislative history that the idea was that a judgment under the Tucker Act, that you did not have to seek, as an additional step, an explicit appropriation to pay the judgment.
But there are two statutes that are relevant to that inquiry. One is the judgment fund statute, and the other is 28 U.S.C. section 2517A, which a predecessor of which was enacted at the same time as the Tucker Act. And that refers specifically to matters for which there are general appropriations, making it clear that Congress only intended matters for which it has appropriated funds to go to this court. And under that view, that because there's a judgment fund which is a matter of last resort to pay judgments for which the court has jurisdiction, under that view, the court would have jurisdiction over all NAFI claims or even any kind of claim, because there's a judgment fund that could pay the judgments.
The Tucker Act is a broad statement that you can sue our sovereign for breach of contract. And here, there's no question, you're not saying that the banking agencies are not acting with the authorization or as agencies of the nation.
But they're not appropriated agencies, and Congress, and of course, any waiver of sovereign immunity must be expressed.
Well, the FDIC, I take it, is subject to the Federal Tort Claims Act, correct? And judgments against the agency agents would be payable by the United States. So the United States would be the defendant in such an action, correct?
Not sure whether the United States would be the defendant, and I
isn't that always the case
in
FTCA cases? I think it's well.
I'll
you're the
that.
Expert.
I don't know, Your Honor. And I think that there is authority in the regional circuits that the FTCA, by its terms, applies to the FDIC in its corporate capacity. I don't think so in its receivership capacity, because the Supreme Court has held that when the FDIC acts as the receiver, it really is the institution. It's not the United States at all. But you have to look at each statute, and that's why this court in...
Are those cases wrong? I mean, that say that they can be sued under the tort, that the United States can be sued under the Tort Claims Act for the actions of the FDIC.
You would have to look at the express statutory language, and that's why there are decisions of this court.
What express statutory? We're talking about Tort Claims Act.
Right.
I think what Judge Bryson is asking you is what's the difference between the United States being liable for FDIC actions under the Tort Claims Act, and what's the difference between their being liable for contracts? Is there a difference between a tort and a contract in terms of the United States' liability for the actions of the FDIC?
These are completely different statutes, and you have to look at the different statutory language, and that's why this court has,
I don't understand. What's the statutory?
Because the Federal Tort Claims Act and the Tucker Act are separate statutes, and
well,
they have
the
separate origins. Excuse me?
What's the difference in the language?
I haven't looked at the Federal Tort Claims Act. I mean, it wasn't raised in the brief, so I'd be happy to look at it and get back to you. I imagine it's broader, just the way this court held that the FLSA is because of the special statutory language in the FLSA that the United States could be sued under the FLSA for actions by NAFIs. But just looking at the statutory language of that statute in that case. So you would have to look at the language of the Federal Tort Claims Act, and some courts have done that and have concluded that it applies to the FDIC. At least
counsel, your contract interpretation or your statutory interpretation hinges on the words "contract with the United States," right? You think when 1491A1 says "contract with the U.S.," that means contract with the U.S. and that should be interpreted as not including NAFIs.
Yes.
Then what would be the necessity for adding the entire latter section of that statute for purposes of this paragraph, an express or implied contract with the Army, the post exchanges, and NASA? Why, if I were to interpret the first sentence as excluding NAFIs, there's no reason to add the second sentence?
Those are specific waivers that Congress agreed to in 1970.
No, 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 but each of those military posts are nappies, right?
They're nappies,
yes.
Congress.
So if the first sentence says contract with the U.S. and that is interpreted as not including nappies, the second sentence is then entirely superfluous.
If it's construed to include nappies, then the second sentence is superfluous. If the first sentence means if contract with the U.S. includes nappies, then enumerating certain nappies becomes superfluous.
And isn't that what happened? I'm confused.
No, because the first sentence does not mean that contracts with non-appropriated fund activities are within the jurisdiction of the Tucker Act. And that's what the Supreme Court had
done. We're saying the first sentence excluded nappies and the second sentence brought back a few of them.
Five specific ones. Yeah. And the legislative history is very clear on that in 1970 and this court's decision in McDonald's explained all of that.
I got it. Okay.
Ms. Davidson, do you want to save
yes,
some
I
of your
do.
Rebuttal
Thank
time?
You.
Mr. Buchanan?
Yes. May it please the court. Government counsel stated quite clearly that what is required for the FDIC to be sued in the Court of Federal Claims is express waiver of sovereign immunity. And the Tucker Act does precisely that. In fact, the Supreme Court, three different cases or four different cases, Monsanto versus Ruckelshaus is one case, and the Mitchell case, and the Williams case, and the Basalt case. And they all talked about the Tucker Act and waiver of sovereign immunity, and they said quite clearly, particularly in the Mitchell case, that the Tucker Act is the broadest and widest, most unequivocal waiver of sovereign immunity.
So your view
for,
is
for the
that
United that States, though?
Yes.
Is the FDIC acting on behalf of the United States at this point? It's acting as its own independent agency and contracting with the banks.
I think.
Does that make the United States liable for appropriated funds in the judgment fund if you sue the United States and not the FDIC?
I think under the Supreme Court precedent, the analysis is the agency or department that's being sued working on behalf or an agent of the United States? That's the first question. The second question is, are they suing for a constitutional taking, a breach of contract, a regulatory violation, or statutory violation? But that's what the Supreme Court case's analysis is, and that's what they found in those cases to be the pertinent questions. So the issue is here, is the FDIC an agency of the United States? Are they acting on behalf of the United States? That's never been disputed in this case.
Well, the difficulty I'm having is if you read the first sentence, so your view of the Tucker Act provision A1 without the exception provision is that all nappies are included within that first sentence. And if that's your view, which I understand you to have said, then I'm having a hard time understanding why the whole amendment, the 1970 amendment, is absolutely superfluous language.
Well, I would go back again to what the Supreme Court has stated on the issue, but in terms of the 1970 amendments, all the Congress did there was to allow for certain military exchanges and the Nassau Exchange.
But under your view of the first sentence, it clearly and unambiguously would have covered everyone in any way. So what would the need have been to have the second exception?
My view is that if those agencies are acting on behalf of the United States, that they would be covered under the Tucker Act, and therefore you wouldn't need that amendment.
You don't need it.
However, why that amendment occurred is because the Court of Claims was denying military personnel the right to sue for back wages and pay and other types of causes of action, and they had nowhere to go. They were being thrown out of the Court of Claims because they were saying they're non-appropriated agencies. They had nowhere else to go. Obviously, there was various dissents that were written in the Court of Claims, and there was a public outcry. So they went
so
to Congress.
What you're saying, I take it, it comes down to this, if I understand your argument. It is that the Tucker Act, without the 1970 amendment, covered everything that is now covered, and the Court of Claims didn't get it with respect to these post exchanges, and therefore Congress fixed that, correct? Is that essentially what you're saying?
Yes.
It wasn't necessary, except for the fact that the Court of Claims had, according to Congress, misread the sweep of the Tucker Act.
So if that's the reason, what about NASA?
There was just four cases at that time in the Court of Claims, and three of them involved military exchange.
But one of them involved something that wasn't a military exchange. Right. So that to the extent that Congress was aware of what was going on out there in the Court of Claims, and apparently they were responding to that, they left out the Grape Crushing Association, or whatever it is, from
Grape Kaya. Administrative Committee.
Yes, the Grape Administrative Committee. Does that not suggest that there was an intention to write more narrowly than covering all of the NAFIs that were out there?
I think the basic canon of statutory construction that we control here is, did Congress in any way endorse the NAFI doctrine as then stated? And the Supreme Court is clear on this, and we've cited the case, that if Congress doesn't take any action to endorse, in this case, certain judicial decisions, such as that in order to sue in the Court of Federal Claims, you have to have appropriated funds, then it has no meaning. And so you cannot rely on it. This court should not rely on the fact that the 1970 amendments merely added certain not appropriated or NAFIs to the jurisdiction of the Court of Federal Claims. They did not speak to the other issues. There was just one other case out there, as you said. So this was, I believe, the focus here, the concern here was with these military personnel.
What you're saying is it's open to us to say that the 1970 amendment was totally unnecessary and that the distinction that they drew is irrelevant to the issues before us, right?
The court does not need to say that the 1970 amendments were unnecessary or not. What I'm saying, and I think what the Supreme Court has said on statutory construction, is the mere fact that Congress did not, took no action to endorse prior to the great finding that the Grape Committee, the Grape Administrative Committee, was not a NAFI. By not doing that they were not endorsing that policy. That was the last.
It seems to be a little bit inconsistent with the Supreme Court's decision in Bilski, where they found that action by Congress to protect some business method patents was a suggestion that not all business method patents were outside the statute.
Well, if in fact Congress were to pass a law that's analogous or accommodates a certain judicial decision, such as Brown and Williamson decisions. In that case, you had a situation where Congress constantly passed laws regulating cigarettes, and the FDA had never attempted to regulate cigarettes. And even though there were decisions that related to that issue. And what it came down to is the Supreme Court said the mere fact that Congress has passed laws in which it's kept to itself the preemption issue, that therefore that the FDA interpreted that to be Congress to state that the FDA did not have a right to regulate cigarettes. And there's several other cases that are similar to that, but the general rule is that with regard to these amendments is you have to have a situation where a court basically adopts the judicial decision in question. So this would have to adopt the doctrine in question. It never spoke to the doctrine. All it did was add these military exchanges to jurisdiction for the Tucker Act. But if you get back to what the Supreme Court has said, I think that's the starting point. And if you get to this court in Lyon Raisins,
why doesn't the action of Congress in bringing some NAFIs within the Tucker Act suggest that with respect to other NAFIs, they're not within the Tucker Act?
Well, because I believe that the court, by just adding those, and I think this is an issue of statutory construction, by adding those, it did not endorse the judicial doctrine. And remember, there's just one other case out there. We're just talking about a single other case at that time. You had the cases on military exchange, you had the Pulaski Cab Company, and you had cases involving the employees of military exchanges. There were
the legislative sides. History shows that Congress was well aware that there were other NAFIs besides the five categories that it brought within the Tucker Act, right?
Well, you had the Senate report that they wanted to get rid of it altogether.
Right. But the House report says that recognizes that there are other NAFIs, right?
That's correct. And the NAFIs they were talking about and their concern was that they were unidentified, that you could have actually sporting clubs.
There are NAFIs that aren't covered by the Tucker Act even today, right? I mean, if the chess club of Fort Myer, for example, as long as it isn't funded and run by Fort Myer, is presumably an independent of the United States.
That's
you couldn't
exactly
sue
right.
the chess club for a contract breach or anything else.
And,
right?
and that's exactly what the House was concerned about, is that somehow
chess club?
The United States, well, they did talk, I believe, about sporting clubs, soccer, and the idea was that people could form clubs under the auspices of the military and could, you know, somehow enter into a contract and get sued there. But I think, again, if you go back to what the Supreme Court has said...
Let me ask you about the language. The language itself, you referred to the military exchanges, but one of the particular exceptions in the statute is for the exchange councils of NASA. Do you know where that comes from? Was there any litigation involving NASA as a NAFI? So I understand the military exchanges, there had been some history with respect to those, but they also singled out the exchange councils of NASA. Is there any basis, and you think, in the legislative history to distinguish that from FDIC or anything else?
No, I did not see anything there. And again, in military exchanges, there were three of the four NAFI cases were about military exchanges. And so that drove...
Well, isn't that further indication that there was no intent to exclude other unenumerated NAFIs, such as FDIC?
Again, I don't believe that the fact that the... You know, clearly they didn't, they could have abolished the doctrine, they didn't. But I don't think the fact that they did not act on the judicial doctrine at the time, again going back to standard canons of statutory construction, means that they endorsed the law, and that's the standard rule. But going back, the Supreme Court has stated, for example, that the fact that an entity, the Congress has stated that a particular entity is not to receive appropriated funds, or are they concerned about the entity spending funds or buying in the government or saving the FISC. And these are the reorganization rail cases, the Monsanto case, the Mitchell cases. They said, notwithstanding that, you know, that doesn't matter. We do not look to these additional regulations and amendments and statutes. We look straight to the Tucker Act, and we assume if this entity is acting on behalf of the United States, then and they bring in a case consistent with the Tucker Act, like a contract case, then they can sue in the Court of Federal Claims. In Alliance Raisins, this court found that for takings cases, you can bring a case, it doesn't, a NAFI can sue in the Court of Federal Claims. So they carved out another huge exception. But in Mitchell, at page 236, the Supreme Court said, there's no distinction between a contract claim or a takings claim under the Tucker Act. So if you read Alliance Raisins and the Supreme Court cases together, then if you can sue for a takings claim under the Tucker Act in the Court of Federal Claims, sue a NAFI, then why can't you sue for breach of contract?
Let me ask you a question before your time runs out. The sue and be sued provisions, which are in the FDIC originating statute, why was this action brought? That's a waiver of sovereign immunity, is it not?
Yes, it is.
So why wasn't the action brought in federal district court by Slattery?
Because the FDIC had already successfully argued and won the 10th Circuit on this very issue. In FARA, U.S. v. FARA, they had argued, and they argued later in 94 and 97, and also in the district group case in 92, that you could not sue the FDIC in federal district court. So we filed the case.
But we held in FARA also that FAR West, that the FDIC could be sued in federal district court.
Concurrent jurisdiction. Yes, but
if in fact there's an issue as to appropriated funds at that point, why wasn't the action then just transferred to the federal district court?
Because
objection? Is there a problem with transferring it without the aspect? Because the sue and be sued, according to the Supreme Court, grants jurisdiction to the federal district court.
That's correct, and the Supreme Court has said where, you know, there's concurrent jurisdiction, and I believe the Federal Circuit as well, if there's concurrent jurisdiction, you can sue in either court. But on FAR West, that was, again, the FDIC taking the position that, you know, the place to sue the FDIC is the Court of Federal Claims. So you're asking, and when I filed this case in May of 1993, the law then, the 10th Circuit, in a position taken by the FDIC, was that I could not sue in federal district court. And they took that position repeatedly thereafter successfully. There's four different cases. And in oral argument to the panel below, the government said in response to questions about that was then, this is now. So this notion is that's where we should have gone. What would have happened then is obvious. They would have filed
a motion. What was their theory as to why you couldn't sue in district court on a contract?
Excuse me, Your Honor?
What was their theory as to why you couldn't sue the FDIC in district court for breach of contract?
Their theory was that the Tucker Act required you to sue the FDIC for breach of contract in the Court of Federal Claims. And FARA and Halsey and an auction company in the D.C. Circuit, if they believed in this position, they wouldn't have taken that position with all these other circuits. If this court were to rule consistent with that, we have a split in the circuits, the case would go to the Supreme Court. But they never took that position, so that was our guidance. They didn't take it till 10 years after this case was filed. They filed multiple other motions. This case was filed in 93. They had motions filed in 94, other motions to dismiss and for summary judgment. They never took this until after they had a trial of liability and much after that. Although they claimed that it was the Furash case that caused them to ultimately file their motion to dismiss on the basis that the FDIC was unhappy. That was a year ahead
Counsel,
of when they filed.
Does the government's current position that contract with the United States does not include NAPI, that NAPIs are not contracting on behalf of the U.S. because of the non-appropriated funds, mean that there's no necessity for any sue and be sued clauses? Because if each NAPI, every single one of them, is not contracting for the U.S., contracting only for itself as an independent institution, then can't all of them be sued in the district court all the time, and there's no need for any sue or be sued clauses?
Well, I think the sue or be sued clause also allows them to seek certain equity relief or injunctive relief. So the FDIC, for instance, if you were to sue them for certain causes of action, other than those stated in the Tucker Act, you'd have to go to the federal district court.
But the sue and be sued clause also waives sovereign immunity. That's the reason why you need the sue and be sued clause.
That's correct.
Well, but if they're not acting as an arm of the government, but rather, as Ms. Davidson refers to them, like a corporation, as an independent institution, do we even need a waiver of sovereign immunity any longer?
Well, for the Court of Claims, you need, in other words...
No, but in the district courts, she says they're not to fall within the Court of Claims jurisdiction because this is not a contract with the government. Her focus is on with the United States. She's saying they're not contracting for the United States.
That's
they're
correct.
Contracting as an independent agency. Well, if they're not part of the U.S.,
exactly.
Then shouldn't that mean they can be sued in any district court?
If they're not a
sovereign immunity waiver necessary.
Right. If they're not the United States, they're not a sovereign, then they do not have sovereign immunity, and therefore you can sue in federal district court. But that's not the position they successfully took.
I'm betting Ms. Davidson's not going to stand up and agree with
you. They're either a sovereign or if they're not the United States, I don't know how you're a sovereign. And to get back to the Lyons Raisins decision here, this court held there that for takings cases, you could sue any NAFI in the Court of Claims.
No, it doesn't say you can sue the NAFI. It says the United States is responsible for the actions of agencies.
But in that case, you were dealing, the court found it was a NAFI, and it said it could be sued.
Yeah, it doesn't make any difference for takings liability because the United States is liable for the actions of its agents, whether they're NAFIs or not.
That's true, but that would also apply for breach of contract, would it not?
Well, that's the question.
Well, I mean, the Supreme Court has said in Mitchell, again, page 236, there's actually no distinction between a contract claim and a takings claim in terms of the Tucker Act. So this court has said you can sue a NAFI in the fact that it has appropriated funds or not, you can sue it in the Court of Claims. And the Constitution does not waive sovereign immunity for takings claims in the Court of Claims. The Tucker Act does that. That's why it specifically states constitutional takings claims therein. If you didn't have that provision in there, you could not sue a NAFI or any government agency that had appropriated funds in the Court of Claims. So, and just, I would add that, back to the standard of Ames, the notion that the FDIC does not receive appropriated funds, I mean, the question again by the Supreme Court is, first of all, there's an unequivocal, broad-based waiver of sovereign immunity of the Tucker Act. So the first question is not for the plaintiff to prove it, that there's some waiver, and to point to some other regulation or statute. You look strictly at the Tucker Act. And then you prove whether it's the United States or they're acting on behalf of the United States or not. And that's what this court found
and Lyons Raisins with, ironically, the Raisin Administrative Committee.
Just a quick factual question. You say at page 56 of your brief that if you had brought this case in the district court, the FDIC would have been subjected to even larger damages. What would be the basis for the larger damages?
Well, if they're not the sovereign, they're not the United States, you can get interest against them.
Interest, I thought so. Okay, that's correct.
Now, in terms of the issue, if we go back and focus on the issue of whether they're a NAFI or not, whether they have funds, currently there are $500 billion appropriated for the FDIC to borrow. And the FDIC chairman has testified on the Hill written letter saying we need this money. They increased it from $30 billion to $100 billion to $500 billion. Those are appropriated funds under Article 1, Section 9 of the Constitution. Treasury funds from Congress to the FDIC. As of December 31, the FDIC had $20.9 billion in the red. So the premiums that were coming from the banks, who they're constantly seizing, were disappearing, that's dried up. So I do not know their exact source of money now, but I fully believe and anticipate that they're drawing down on these funds that come through one of these mortgage and housing statutes. That's where the line of funds are coming from. They're drawing down. So they're actually using, or will be using, Treasury funds. Appropriate funds, even if they have to pay them back.
Is that in the record?
That's in the record below, no, because we couldn't put that in there because that was not an issue. The fact that that money was not there yet, but certainly in the briefs below, we argued about the borrowing, and I would add that.
You don't know the terms and conditions of the loans.
Oh, I would fully expect that those loans, they have to pay them back. But how do you pay back? I mean, with this banking crisis, 100, 200, 300.
The question is whether or not those were loans. If they're loans, they have to be paid back.
They are loans. But in the Federal Circuit and General Electric, and the court below, and Hughes Aircraft, and Brightbeck involving the St. Lawrence Seaway, and then also the National State Bank of Newark, this court said whether you're talking about borrowings or you're talking about the full faith and credit. And in Brightbeck, it was the St. Lawrence Seaway, and they did not have appropriated funds, but they could borrow. That was enough to find that it was not a NAFI. In the National State Bank of Newark, there it was FHA debentures. They were backed up by the full faith and credit of the treasurer. There were not funds there appropriated. It was a backup like this, the full faith and credit, and they found that it was not a NAFI. Now, so we have initially with the we have $100 million that was put into the FDIC when it started, with no obligation to pay it back, even though it was paid back some 14 years later. You have a $500 billion line of credit, and you have in every FDIC-insured bank, the full faith and credit of the United States stands behind it. And the government tries to say, that goes to the deposit insurance fund. Well, the first of all, the FDIC's sole purpose is to insure deposits of banks. All the premiums that it gets to operate all of its functions, including insurance functions, come hopefully from banks. That fund is dried up. They now have to use treasury funds in the form of borrowings, and you have the full faith and credit to back that up. Now, if the fund fails and banks fails, the funds all come in together. So whether they're bank funds, whether they're treasury funds in the form of a loan, or they're appropriated funds, they come in, they pay for all the functions because there's no other source of income. And that's what would happen here. And the function in this case was the acquisition of Western Savings in 1982 by Meritor at the behest of the FDIC. We had a contract with the FDIC, and that went to the exact activity that we're talking about here, to cover the deposit insurance fund of the United States. We acquired Western, which had a $700 million a negative net worth in the form of its difference between deposits and mortgages. And what the FDIC stated in a press release, and they admitted below, and the chairman of the FDIC testified, was that but for Meritor taking over Western Savings and Loan, they would have to liquidate the institution and paid out $700 million from the insurance fund. So we became, in effect, the insurer. We took that bank over, we took over the deposit liabilities, and that, according to the FDIC, its chairman and their admissions, avoided them having to use $700 million in funds from the BIF. So that is the activity. It's directly related to the full faith and credit guarantee of Congress in this case. So I have 2 minutes, and I reserved some time for
the 2 minutes is yours to spend, Mr. Buchanan. We have allotted separate time for Mr. Smith.
Okay. So, again, I would state that where the court needs to begin is to look at Supreme Court decisions in Peralt and in Mitchell and in Williams and in Monsanto versus Ruckelhaus. And all those cases, they looked at the agency in question to determine whether it was acting at the behest of the United States. And once they determined that, and several were takings, but the Mitchell case was not a takings case, that was a regulatory violation case. And they said in all those cases that it was irrespective of whether there was money that was appropriated or not, those entities could be sued in the Court of Federal Claims because of the Tucker Act and how broad the waiver of sovereign immunity was. And this case, this court followed Perot and Mitchell in Lyons Raisin, where it said, and it held, that even though the defendant was a NAFI, it could be sued in the Court of Federal Claims because it was a takings case. Now, the Judgment Act no more provides money for a takings case or any other case, according to the government, unless the entity has appropriated funds. But in that case, they held, well, it's a takings case, so therefore, they said this in footnote 7 in Lyons Raisin, they said, we assume that any judgment based on the takings will be paid out of the judgment fund. And I would add that the FDIC filed an amicus brief in the 3-judge panel in which it said that the judgment in this case will be paid from the judgment fund. It's a separate fund, and that's where it would be paid. And that's what they stated below. So we have the FDIC taking various positions at various times. Today, you've heard the United States, who's obviously being paid by the Treasury, not the FDIC, representing the FDIC, telling you that any judgment in this case would have to come from the FDIC, where meanwhile, its client says something totally the opposite. And then they've taken repeatedly different positions on this very issue, and depending on what court they're in.
Thank you, Mr. Brinkman. Mr. Smith, you have a brief 4 minutes.
Good morning. May it please the court, I'm Brad Smith from Sullivan & Cromwell, counsel to plaintiffs, cross appellants, Stephen Roth and Interstate Properties. I want to focus my argument on the key issue that's been the subject of this morning's conversation. And with respect to us, it's what is the effect of the NAFI doctrine on our client, Stephen Roth's claims? And I would submit to the court that the NAFI doctrine does not have an effect, because even if the FDIC is a NAFI, that would not prevent our clients from pursuing their takings claims. As this court recognized in Lyons Raisin, there is no question that NAFIs are agents of the United States, and the United States incurs takings liability for the acts of its agents. Accordingly, our client's takings claims, based upon the FDIC's conduct, are against the United States, founded upon the Constitution.
What do you do with Section 1821 and the limitation on judicial review in that section?
That's a fair question, Your Honor. We believe that the panel decision correctly found and correctly agreed with the Tenth Circuit's decision in Homeland Stores. And what the analysis is that 1821d13d channels claims that could have been brought against the seized institution into a special proceeding. I don't believe, however, that it can channel a takings claim such as the one that we have asserted, because the language of the statute clearly doesn't cover those kinds of claims.
Well, the second portion of D talks not just against claims that presumably would have been brought against the institution, but talks about claims that would be brought against the FDIC pertaining to acts or omissions of the corporation. So that sounds like the kind of thing that is the activities of the FDIC in the course of its operating its receivership, right?
Your Honor, I think
pretty broad language.
I agree that it's pretty broad language. I think that the problem and the issue that the panel wrestled with and that the Tenth Circuit wrestled with is that the language is so broad that I think if it were applied in its broadest sense, it would actually prevent us from asserting a claim in any court. Because I don't believe that the types of claims that are authorized under the statute to be brought before the district court, I don't believe the language describing those kinds of claims actually would apply to the takings claim that we have asserted. So if you reinterpreted the statute in that fashion, we would be left with nowhere to go, which I think is what drove the panel below and the Tenth Circuit to conclude that the statute needed to be construed in a way such that post-receivership claims, particularly the type of takings claim that we have asserted, can be brought.
But takings is only one of your claims, I take it. You have several claims, and takings is unique in that it's self-executing. So there isn't any problem with sovereign immunity, and you're going to be able to bring your claim.
Correct, Your Honor. We have
asserted. But the other claims are subject to limitations, including limitations that would say, "Sorry, no court can entertain your claims." Right.
I think that certainly other types of claims can be excluded, although in fairness to our complaint, I think the other two claims that we have presented are derivative of the takings claim.
Okay.
They basically allow, we're seeking based on the taking that took place, we're asking the court below to make a declaratory judgment.
And just to be clear, the Court of Federal Claims with respect to your claim rejected your claim, saying finding they had no jurisdiction in contrast to
correct,
the action
Your Honor.
With respect
the,
to
the Court of Federal Congress. Claims dismissed our claims, finding a lack of jurisdiction. The panel decision reversed that finding, and this court has now obviously vacated the panel decision. But going back to your question, I think that the Court of Federal Claims made an error is in deciding that it did not have jurisdiction on the basis that the FDIC is not the United States. But what we learned from Lyon Raisin is that that's not the appropriate question. The question is not, as the Court of Federal Claims framed it, of whether the FDIC sometimes can be adverse to the United States. The question is whether the conduct that the FDIC has engaged in was conduct on behalf of the United States, particularly when it engaged in the taking under the Constitution. And we think that under that standard, our client's claims should be allowed to proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Smith. Ms. Davidson, you have about 5 minutes remaining.
Thank you. I'd first like to respond to the question from Judge Dyke and Judge Bryson about the FTCA. My colleagues have reminded me that the FTCA expressly applies to sue and be sued agencies, and therefore some regional circuit courts have held that the FDIC is an agency within the FTCA definition of agency. But of course, that's a different statute. That was my point before, but I'd like to respond to that question. I'd also like to go back to where I started with Hopkins, which is the Supreme Court's fullest explanation of the standard for determining an unappropriated fund instrumentality. And all the Supreme Court said was, does the activity receive appropriated funds? And we respectfully submit that that should be the test. It's clear, it can apply easily, and most importantly, it provides predictability so that parties can look and see, am I contracting with an entity that receives appropriated funds or not? And it can know at the outset.
Contract with the FDIC, a contract with the sovereign.
The FDIC is part of the government, and in Standard Oil, which was the first time the Supreme Court looked at non-appropriated fund activities, the Supreme Court said they are part of the United States, but the United States does not assume responsibility for their liabilities. So
it is literally a contract with the government, with the United
States. It is part of the sovereign. It is part of the United States, and a waiver of sovereign immunity is necessary in order to sue the FDIC or any non-appropriated fund instrumentality. And that's why some NAFIs can't be sued, because there's been no waiver. But under the Hopkins standard, a party would know. There wouldn't be any uncertainty, as there is under what became sort of a detour with L'Enfant Plaza and has now been somewhat realigned with Farash and Ains, and I respectfully submit is where the panel in this case was led astray, and that is this fourth prong of the Ains test, which is really a recognition of the L'Enfant Plaza decision. And that prong, the fourth prong, which is the only one that really doesn't go to or their current appropriations. It says there must be a clear expression by Congress that this entity will not receive appropriated funds. But Congress, first of all, it can't bind a future Congress. So a Congress could not pass a law, even if it were in the business of passing laws stating what its future intentions were. It couldn't pass a law saying no Congress will ever appropriate funds for this activity. And we have seen some non-appropriated fund activities that Congress has decided over time to provide appropriated funds for. So Congress has to have that flexibility, and to create as a requirement that Congress must clearly express that this activity will not receive appropriated funds imposes an impossible burden on Congress and is goes way beyond what the Supreme Court said the test was, which is, does this entity receive appropriated funds? Now, with Lion Raisins, the rule for taking is, was it the United States or an agent of the United States? And the law is that even a private party could be an agent of the United States for purposes of a taking. So the court in Lion Raisins held that a NAFI could be an agent of the United States for purposes of the takings law, but that doesn't mean that the Court of Federal Claims has jurisdiction for contract actions. A lot of the cases that were cited about the early 90s, I mean, it'll take a while to go through all of them, but some of them involved the FERF and the FDIC in resolving the thrift crisis, and those were appropriated fund activities, and those cases really got sorted out after this court's decision in Far West, which explains that if the FDIC is using appropriated funds, then it could be sued in the district court under its sue and be sued authority, or the United States could be sued in the Court of Federal Claims. But that's not this case. So some of those cases that are cited do involve appropriated funds, but it's an entirely separate part of the FDIC, and it's required to be kept separate from the bank insurance funds. Also, the loan, the borrowing authority, the same exact statute existed in Farash involving the Federal Housing Financing Board, and this court held that that was a NAFI, even though that entity had borrowing authority, and that the statutory language is identical for that entity and the FDIC. None of those claims also, by the way, going back to the early 90s when there was some confusion, but none of those decisions discussed the NAFI doctrine at all. So I think it's unfair, and certainly Mitchell didn't discuss it, so it's unfair to say that in those cases, whatever they were talking about, whatever statutory scheme and whatever confusion may have existed, they weren't even talking about the NAFI doctrine.
You have a final thought for us, Ms. Davidson?
Thank you for your time, Your Honor.
Thank you to counsel for their assistance today.
All rise.